Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about what worked, but also those big epic fails I made along the way. And I talk to experts because I really believe that there are so many people who are experts on different aspects of creativity, and that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And today I am talking to an expert who I actually met at a conference. I was doing a keynote at this conference. It was really great. And I started talking, I was actually on his podcast, this person named Brett. I'll be sharing his bio here in just a second. And I was struck by our shared interests in books that we read and podcasts that we listen to and ideas that we nerd out on, but also his expertise in terms of technology and what it means for both curiosity and creativity. So I'm going to share a little bit about him. Brett Fisher is an English as a second language teacher and researcher in Montreal, Canada. He holds a PhD in integrated sciences and education from McGill University and has led projects funded by the Canada-Quebec Agreement and the focus that he tends to have is on learner autonomy, short-term pedagogical study abroad, and learning in authentic contexts. He's deeply committed to improving teaching and learning, and has contributed to several institutional and provincial committees, including the revision of the new ministerial ESL curriculum framework. His notable achievements include the article Teachers' Perspectives on Pedagogy in Short-Term Language Study Abroad, published in Foreign Language Annals, the website Facilitating Study Abroad, and he's just been and the podcast that that I was actually on, called Rascals Roundtable. He is truly one of those deep dive researchers who also makes things really practical because he has that firsthand experiential knowledge. And so I am really excited about having him on this podcast. Without further ado, here is Brett Fisher. All right, we have with us Brett Fisher. Welcome to this podcast. And we met at a conference in Quebec, and I was really impressed by kind of your knowledge of creativity, the way you engage with it, the way you think about it. And so I'm curious, we'll get to your research a little bit, we'll talk about that, but I'm wondering if you would tell your story a little bit about how you got into education, where you come from, just a little bit about yourself.
Oh, that's a long story. For the purposes of brevity, I would just say I had two parents who were teachers. Okay. And I had, like most people, some hit and miss experiences in high school. And there was a part of me that just kind of thought I could do better than this. I had an aunt who was a teacher at CEGEP, which for people who aren't familiar with CEGEP is Canadian. It's a Quebec specific, basically kind of grade 13, first year university, like junior college type thing. And she was a teacher at one of these CEGEPs, and she asked me to help her out. And I really enjoyed helping her. And I thought, oh, this is cool. This is probably the level that I want to teach at. So I oriented my career towards that.
Oh, wow. In terms of your career, one of the topics that you got into with your research, one of the things that you think about is creativity of the student and the teacher level. What specifically was it about the topic of creativity that drew you in?
Ah, great question. Yeah. So it wasn't as linear as my choice to become a teacher. It started because when I was given tenure, most people, it's like a very woohoo celebratory moment, pop the champagne. Yeah. And for me, it was very anticlimactic. In fact, I think it came as a blow. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be doing this for the next 20 years. Like this is my life for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure. I actually had a flashback to this one teacher that I had who I really loved in elementary school, and she left teaching. Like she completely left it. And I was devastated. I couldn't figure out why somebody who was the world's most incredible teacher who had such an impact on my life would leave teaching. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking to myself, I don't ever want to be the kind of teacher who's just stuck in their job. And teaching, so like, it's specialized. You get a Bachelor of Education. It's not a bachelor's in business where you can then do all sorts of different kinds of careers and you change every 3 years. You know, most of my friends who are in business constantly changing companies and they're changing roles and get salary raises. Whereas teachers, it's like you're trained to be a teacher. So where else do you go? You can go into admin, which just feels very foreign. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily have training in leadership as teachers. So, it's something that, It's quite a shift to go into that. And then there's teacher adjacent kinds of things like consulting, I suppose. So I felt trapped and I thought, I don't want to burn out. I don't want to be a teacher who doesn't like this. So what's the next step? And I thought, why wouldn't I just look at teachers who have been teaching for a really long time and who love it?
Yeah.
And who just have the greatest time and are still super engaged in what they're doing. So that was where it all started for me, was looking at these teachers, and then creativity kind of flowed out of that.
So when you think about it, creativity became this sort of lifeline in a way to keep the ideas fresh, to stay sustained in your teaching practice. What was it specifically about creativity that made it that way? Was it that it provided novelty? Was it that it led to more motivation? Was it that you could see the quality of your work go up? Like, let's go a little more granular. Like, what was it about creativity?
Okay. I'll give a little theoretical background on this. So there's a guy named Huberman who did some studies like in the 80s, back when they had really big funding for qualitative studies. It was very impressive to see how many people he interviewed in this. I'm assuming it was a whole team, but it's just cited as Huberman. So I don't know what those uncited research assistants, I'm sure, thousands of hours of interviews with teachers. And they essentially defined the life cycle of a teacher, the professional life cycle of a teacher. And you go through five phases. And the last two phases seem kind of dark. Like the final phase is just disengagement. You're just not even really interested in teaching. You're just kind of crossing off the days, getting through until you're retired. And we've seen those teachers and we know about them. And then there was this small kind of, they weren't the focus of his study, but there was a small group of outliers. And they were engaged. They just didn't go through these phases in the same way that the majority of people were. And one of the things that was postulated was that it was perhaps some kind of creativity that was insulating them. They were tending their own little gardens.
Yeah.
And that's the part that really sparked the interest for me, because I was meeting with these teachers who I admired, who were incredible people, just doing these huge province-wide initiatives. And I thought, these people are all super creative. Like they're all, you know, like in terms of like Maslow's pyramid, they're also, and you know, Maslow even talked about that. These people who are in the self-actualizing kind of top of the pyramid, they tend to also have more creativity in their approach to life. And so that was the kind of theory. There were enough pieces of the puzzle that were already in place fundamentally. And so I started thinking about, are these people cultivating some kind of creativity? And is it something that, you know, like, is it something like you go to the gym and you can, you know, beef up your creativity? Or is it something like you're just born with a fixed amount of creativity and some people are creative and some people aren't? And if it is something you can beef up at the gym, how do you beef it up? What do you have to do to get more creative? And what can I do to be more creative and hopefully stay a super engaged and happy teacher all the way to the end of my career? Wouldn't that be nice? So,
And what did you find there?
I found there were, I mean, it's been a while now, actually, this research. But if I were to give a quick summary, I would say that there are a few major processes that you can engage in that are going to help you to stay more creative. The first one is it's an introspective process, is really thinking about, why did you become a teacher? Mm-hmm. Who are the teachers who inspired you? What did they do? What were the things that you hope, what are some of the things you hope to accomplish as a teacher? I like the, you know what, I'm going to find this book behind me afterwards, but I don't have it with me right now, but it's Designing Your Life. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was about having a compass, not a map. Mm-hmm. And so you don't necessarily know everything that's going to happen on your path, but you know what direction you're headed in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's super important for creativity. Well, the research that I did anyway showed that was really important, that these creative teachers, they were on the lookout. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of irons in the fire. They didn't necessarily know what exactly that was going to take, where exactly their projects would take them or lead them to next, or who they would meet and how things would change. But they knew the direction they were headed in, mm-hmm. and they were keeping their eyes peeled.
It was so really... Oh, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. No, no.
I mean, it was interesting to me because when I, like I said, I read your dissertation because I'm curious about when people do research on creativity, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about my dissertation, which was about teachers implementing project-based learning, which is mm-hmm. such a different thing because it's not learning a new strategy. It's a totally different way of doing, right? Which is big.
Yeah. Paradigm shift.
Huge paradigm shift. And so like what I found was teachers with high self-efficacy were willing to continue when they ran into hurdles and struggles, and they would fail during the process. Your first PBL, you're going to hit a lot of challenges, right? And then the other piece was that those who were most likely to do project-based learning and to continue to sustain through it were on self-determination theory, were really high at identified and integrated regulation. So in other words, they were people mm-hmm. who had sort of, they were motivated by goals and by processes and by things that they see, but not by external factors. Mm-hmm. Or the highest group was they were motivated by a sense of self, their own. Mm-hmm. And it's not intrinsic. Intrinsic is I'm doing it out of a sense of fun and enjoyment. It was this is who I am, right? So it came down to this level there. And I remember thinking at the time, that's why I was so intrigued by your research. What is the role of creativity and curiosity into both of those? Because I feel like, yes, we can talk about being motivated to do things. We can talk about having self-efficacy and continuing when it gets to be a challenge. But it would seem that those teachers I saw who actually implemented PBL had to be creative and had to be curious. You know what I mean? Like those elements, and I'm not saying across the board all the time, but there was this aspect that I remember thinking, which was behind the scenes, not being measured, but me observing, I'm going, oh, that person is engaged in a creative process. Mm-hmm. And that person is being really curious. And the curiosity piece, I think, was really important, which was when you ran into challenges, instead of judging yourself, you looked at it and you said, I wonder why. I wonder how. Like you approach challenges from a mindset of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I'm making any sense here. So I bring all that up right now because I'm curious when you talk about teachers being introspective. When you talk about them being creative, do you think curiosity plays a role in that at all as well?
It's a great question. I think that's so interesting. You know, there are a lot of that was making me think of Carol Dweck's research on the growth mindset. And there's something about that. Yeah, like there's a certain kind of aspect of resilience, which is, you know, seeing setbacks and failure not necessarily as well, for some people they could be devastating. Yeah. You know, like I'm doing so well and all of a sudden I hit a wall and I must not be very good at this. Yeah. And that's it, you know, and like, oh, well, that's it. We tried project-based learning and doesn't really work for me or doesn't work in my class. And then there's other people who are just energized by that challenge, who find that so curious, like, why didn't it work with this one group of students or why didn't, and that's a really interesting area. I don't know what the research is on the teacher curiosity. I would say it's probably something that bridges the gap between what you did and what I did, you know, teacher curiosity, because it's so tied to resilience as well. And I think that you've got to be resilient and you've got to be curious to be creative, and you've probably got to be all three of those things to want to be the kind of teacher who engages in project-based learning. So you're getting a lot of everything's in everything. I don't know. I didn't research curiosity specifically. But I love the question. I mean, I think it's really cool to wonder about the intersections between curiosity and creativity.
So one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this podcast is thinking about this idea of teacher creativity. And if we have time, we'll get to the student creativity side too. But I remember messaging you, and I quoted you in a blog post as well, on this idea of how AI will redefine creativity. And one of the things I've seen is the way that AI sort of gets marketed to teachers right now, and rightfully so, is it's a great time-saving thing. It can do tasks for you that you're doing right now. You know, that kind of stuff. And there's probably a time and a place for that, right? We want to see it. But if creativity is vital to be engaged in your entire career, what is the danger of sort of offsetting so many aspects of the creative side of teaching, lesson planning, developing resources, coming up with ideas, to a machine rather than engaging in that yourself?
I think that's looking at it from a very limited angle. I don't think that's the approach that I would take to using AI in terms of being creative. I would look at AI as more of a sounding board. Mm-hmm. That's going to actually, or like even a springboard. Uh-huh. That's gonna take my creativity to the next level. Uh-huh. So it's a way to do multiple iterations of a project. So you could say, you know, like, let's try it this way. No, I don't like the way that, you know, some of this looked. Try it this way. And it's infinitely patient, you know, and it's like, great idea, Brett. Let's try it this way. You know, like I mentioned this to you in our exchange. Yeah. When I first read about Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, I thought, oh my God, I'm looking for my Daniel Kahneman or my Amos or whatever, you know, like this person with whom I can have all of these exchanges and who challenges me, who pushes back and who makes me think about things in a different way. And yes, ideally that's done with a person, you know, like that's some really great chemistry, working chemistry, if you have that with a person where you can push back and kind of be like, I'm not sure you're on the right track with this idea. Mm-hmm. And so far, I don't think AI is going to say, I don't think you're on the right track with this idea. So you're going to be missing that part, but you're going to have so many other things that you can have. I mean, you could maybe even program it to do that. That actually, you know, scratch that. You probably could program AI to do that.
There is something right about now, that. I will say, like, it defaults to being too nice, right? Like, if there's a danger I've seen is we created pro-social robots to be so pro-social that It's like, great idea, great idea, great idea.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, it's the...
You could probably program that out. You could probably tell AI, like, you know...
I need you to be more critical. I need you to be a thought partner who's going to spar with me on ideas. Yeah. And it is fantastic. Like, I've done that a little bit before. It'd be like, I need you to take on the role of a critic right now. Or take on... And you talked a little bit in our text exchange about this notion of like having a dynamic partner to help you with your creativity. And I'm wondering if you could speak into like, what would that look like?
Yeah, I think that having, okay, so setting AI up in such a way that it remembers all of your project history. So it's got this incredible memory. It's got all of these resources at hand, and you're bouncing ideas back and forth between each other. And you're saying, you know, like, what about this way? Or what about this way? Or let's try it this way. And it's willing to do it. It could be one of your greatest creative tools. So I don't think it's taking away my chance to be creativity. In fact, if anything, I think it's helping me to be more creative in everything that I do. Yeah. It's taking away what I think is a lot of the menial stuff that I didn't want to have to do particularly badly anyway. You know, like, I love coming up with the concept of a really great evaluating grid. I know for some people that's, you know, like, whoa, I mean, like, what a waste of time. But I love it if I can really push an evaluation to be something way more like, okay, so I look at my evaluation grid and I'm thinking, how can I make it more of a feedback circle? How do I make it so that the students have, you know, they're telling me what they're trying to achieve, and then I'm looking at what I think they've achieved, but they're also looking at what they think they've achieved, and we're evaluating success together so that in the next cycle of whatever we're doing, they're reinvesting that learning and they're getting better and they're showing improvement. So how do we make evaluation into experiential learning? Where it's just everything becomes a chance to get better. And that's really ultimately what we want in education is, you know, like up spiraling, getting better through successive iterations. And so if I'm working with AI, I can actually help it. I can have it help me to conceptualize this kind of evaluation and give me different ideas. And it has access to everything. Teachers are prolific writers. I mean, we publish tons of different ideas on the net, so, you know, it has access to all of these different things, you know, and it's like, well, what about this? Or have you tried doing this? And so it's great. I feel like I've become a much more creative teacher as a result of AI, as opposed to what, I guess, could you say AI has taken away? No, I mean, there's just no way. If somebody told me they're less creative because of AI, I'd probably just say, well, I don't think you know what AI can do.
But that's really interesting, because part of what you're getting at is you're using it in a way where the AI is a thought partner.
Yeah.
Not someone you're outsourcing to directly, or not someone that's replacing. So you're talking about the difference between truly this, I mean, Ethan Mollick talks about the idea of cyborg and centaur, right? So you're really talking about the cyborg. You're talking about this blending of human and machine together, where you end up doing something together that you couldn't do on your own, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But
very cyborg. I get what you're saying now.
It's very cyborg, right? But that takes a level of intentionality and thoughtfulness that isn't always the default. Like, one of the things I think about is there are a lot of AI tools for teachers, and they're great. They're not all, I'm not saying that they're negative, but it is very possible for a teacher to pop in the standards and say, generate a lesson plan for me, now assessments, now this, and sort of offset this piece that they don't like the machine does it for them, and then they go and they deliver the lesson.
Yeah.
And that would seem to be sort of not using it creatively. Whereas what you're describing is really, hey, here's the criteria I'm looking for. I need you to be my thought partner. We need to work on this together. We need to and that's a much more creative approach. I can tell you, I am more intentional with my rubrics than I ever have been before. I am creating better rubrics. They are more differentiated and they're more creative and they're more student friendly. And I walk through multiple iterations with the rubrics than when I used to just create them from scratch, right? Like I know that I actually am paying better attention to rubric design, which is a funny thing to care about, but I do, right? Than I did before, right? So on some level, it can be this thing. But I could also just as easily say, I'm teaching blank, make me a rubric and then print the rubric off and use it, right? Like that's the danger.
But I mean, I don't even think that that's a danger. Like to me, that's just freeing up bandwidth. If I can free up some bandwidth on something that I think is just a small menial task that, you know, I don't need to put a lot of thought into this. Great. Do these 100 small things for me in my day.
Yeah.
And then again, it's still freeing up all of this mental space for me to be able to, and like teachers care. If there's one, if there's, you know, if there's a profession, if there's one thing that we can say about teachers is on the whole, we're a very caring group of people. I mean, there's probably like more caring burnout than anything.
Yeah.
But we care. And we're, if you're a teacher and you're getting it to help you make a rubric, I'm betting you're probably still putting just as much time into your teaching. And you're probably spending a lot of time just thinking about other puzzles that you've got going on in your classroom. And you're like, you know, little Tommy does this and I don't know. And like, how do I get him to be more engaged and stuff like that? And so you're outsourcing having, you know, AI create different things, but we've outsourced a lot of work as teaching from the beginning. We there are not enough hours in the week for any of us to be the kind of teacher that we aspire to be. Mm-hmm. So it's always going to be a trade-off. Like it doesn't matter. Even if I worked 90 hours a week, every week, there would still be more things that I could do to be a better teacher. Because
one of the things I have thought about is, you know, like, there's been a conversation around AI and we don't want it to replace the teacher, which is valuable. And, you know, there's something dehumanizing about replacing things with a machine. But I would argue that the most dehumanizing elements of teaching are already in place. It's not giving people prep time, think time. It's crowding them with too many students. It's, you know, there's a lot of, in terms of creativity and teaching, probably the most dangerous thing around is so common here in the US where I am, which is outright scripted curriculum where teachers cannot deviate from a script.
Brutal. So
like, if we're worried about cognitive atrophy for students, or we're worried about a lack of creativity for teachers, I would argue like the most dangerous thing is probably not AI. It's still the packaged scripted, you cannot deviate from it. I mean, I remember going to a school before and the teacher said, I should be able to go through the hallway with doors open and hear a continuous lesson where everyone's continuing the script as they go. And my heart sank. I just was like, oh, no, 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 no. That's not, right? So imagine being that, like being a chef and being told like, you can only use Betty Crocker or you know what I mean? Like, it just felt like this super duper tight recipe style of teaching.
I forgot about, yes, there were, you got stuck with this No Child Left Behind, which had admirable intentions. It really did, you know, like, and it's so nicely packaged and you hear that and you're like, No Child Left Behind. That sounds beautiful. And it's a great idea in theory. Like if we can just really boil it down to the science of it and then, you know, teach everything, everyone to the same test and like, and make sure that it's all standards based. And so it's just, it's incredibly dehumanizing is the problem.
Yeah.
And you're not going to like, no two students are the same. No two teachers are the same. No two days are the same. The same lesson plan in the morning isn't the same lesson plan as the in the afternoon. And so, I mean, none of that. It's such a great idea, but it's kind of like communism. Like it sounded really good on paper, and then it's like you put it in practice, and you're like, oh, it really didn't work out anywhere, did it? Yeah. And I would just say the same thing, like. You know, and so to circle it back to AI, if you want to touch that on, you know, touch back to that is the kind of anchoring theme here, is that I think that we're going to be able to be more creative if we can free up some of the space on our hard drives mentally, hand those over, but also then start using AI in a much more creative way, in a way where we think of it as a partner who's great at certain things and not great at other things. And like I read about this school that's using the 2 hour, the students spend 2 hours. I think it's a middle school or something. They spend 2 hours a day with AI. And, you know, that's obviously going to get a huge reaction out of teachers, right? There are massive advantages to that. You can have a student who's just absolutely obsessed with dinosaurs and says, explain this math concept to me using dinosaurs. Yep. Great. AI is going to boom, you know, here, you know, and here's a visual and here's this and here's that. And then it's going to give you feedback, like quiz me on it and tell me what I'm doing right and tell me how to improve. And the student can get so much feedback and it's all geared to what they're, but at the end of the day, you can't take the human judgment element out of that. Mm-hmm. And so you're still going to need teachers. You're going to need teachers who aren't just there as babysitters to like kind of like make sure that everybody's in front of their computer and doing what they're supposed to be doing. You're still going to need teachers who have the judgment of what direction we're supposed to be taking these students in. Mm-hmm. And what ultimately is the value of learning these kinds of concepts? And how are we going to then have the students come together and apply them and actually do something in the real world with them? So like AI is not coming for our jobs. We can farm out, I think, some of the smaller, more detailed drill and trill kind of stuff to AI and get AI as our partners and working with us and doing these kinds of things for us so that we can think of the big things, like you said, like project-based learning. So it's like, okay, so it's going to help you with this little math drill because there's this concept that you're just really struggling with, but you're going to be on this computer, you're going to work on this, you're going to have it tell you about dinosaurs and math, and you're going to get that one concept. And then when you're ready, you're going to join the group and you're going to be, you know, this is your role in the group and we're all together producing this super cool thing. And AI is not going to do that for you. It's never going to do that for you, but you're going to, I mean, again, I'm not going to say never, but we're a hell of a long ways from it being able to do all of that kind of stuff. So the human element still needs to be there, the human judgment and the human connection, because that's really what matters at the end of the day. That's why we're teachers. That's what we're there for. So I think it can make us way more creative, and hopefully will.
When you think about this idea of teachers using AI creatively, right, and how AI has the potential to actually boost human creativity and create these new opportunities, it's a different vision, I think, than a lot of what we have been hearing. I mean, there's been a lot of fear. There's been a lot of worry about academic integrity, which is true. I mean, you need to be cognizant. Kids are going to use AI to cheat, you know, those types of things. And a lot of the conversation has been at the student level. But one of the things I really appreciate is how you have thought through this idea of teacher creativity and AI and how it will potentially help us maintain our creativity, but also in the long run, have a more sustainable career, right? So you don't hit those stages of disengagement. Given that reality, let's imagine for a moment that you have someone who's a teacher, fairly engaged, let's say year 15, 20, veteran teacher, but certainly not hitting that disengagement stage, things like that, has always stayed on top of tech, has always stayed on top of new strategies, but felt blindsided, 2-3 years ago when generative AI really started hitting the scene. What would you hope to see that teacher do in terms of mindset around creativity and AI?
About mindset and creativity and AI.
And maybe mindset's not the right word, but like, what approach would you love to see them take?
To see them, I mean, I don't think you need to have AI to be a great teacher. So like, I mean, I think you could just leave it out. Like if it's not your jam, like that's fine with me. I wouldn't insist on it, but I would insist on you knowing about AI because your students know about AI and start to think about what are they going to do with AI and how is it going to affect what they need to be able to do in the future. Like I'll give you an example. I remember being younger And my math teacher said to me, he's like, Fisher, you got to know how to do this because you're not always going to have a calculator. Uh-huh. And like, you know, ta-da, like, you know, 40 yeah. years later, I always have a calculator in my hand. I literally always have a calculator. Uh-huh. So yeah, I mean, sure. And yeah, it's still great to be able to do, you know, like basic addition and subtraction in my head. Uh-huh. But I'm never going to do it for number, you know, like huge numbers. I'm not multiplying 26 by 38 in my head. Like that's, I don't feel like I need to, and I can live a perfectly happy and fulfilled life without that. And so I think the students are going to, AI is going to change their life and their future. Mm-hmm. And so it's our job to think about what are some of these changes and what are some of the things that they're always just going to be farming out to AI from now on. Mm-hmm. And so it's useful to have them understand certain concepts, but it's not useful to drill certain concepts that they're not going to actually have to use spontaneously. So it's like overlearn what's essential, mm-hmm. but we need to figure out what is essential. Mm-hmm. And that's changed. And if you're not part of that conversation, then I think you're missing out. Like, okay, for example, let's go back to this teacher who needs to change their mindsets. So they're still having students do take-home exams. And they're saying, okay, you know, like do a take-home exam, answer these questions. Now, if they don't scaffold that properly for their students mm-hmm. and break it down into all of these small usable parts. I did a really interesting interview with Marie Gervaise Pilon, and I can give you the link for the show notes or whatever yeah. if you want. And she said, basically, if you don't break that down into all of these small, distinct tasks and then make sure that they can do all of these small, distinct tasks before you give them this, you know, massive project, most of the students are just going to feed that through AI nowadays. But if you've broken it down into small, distinct tasks that they feel really confident that they can do, and then they're like, hey, I actually kind of want to be able to do this because I know it and I'm good at it, then they'll probably do it on their own. So we have to change a mindset about, yeah, it's maybe not even a good idea to do a take-home exam, but if I am doing it, then there are some new things that I have to keep in mind. Because if they're not properly prepared nowadays, like it's just going to get fed through AI. So there are things that are shifting that we need to be aware of and that are fundamentally changing the way students interact with each other, the way they work and their job prospects. And those things we have to be aware of. You have to keep your eye on the big picture nonetheless, even if you don't want to use AI yourself in your classroom and or teach students how to use AI in a way that makes them more creative and productive. I think you're doing yourself a disservice by doing that, but I wouldn't force it on a teacher.
Yeah. What are your final thoughts? So, you know, you've shared a lot of ideas here, which I really appreciate. You answered. Conversation has been a little bit all over the place, partly because of me. but I really appreciated your thoughts on teacher creativity in particular and AI, because I don't feel like we have enough conversations around that. So I really appreciate it. What is a final thought you would want to leave people with as they think about and continue the conversation on their own?
I would stick to what I know best, which is to say sustainable teacher creativity. Your first step is figuring out what direction you're going in. Your mm-hmm. second step is going to be about surrounding yourself with people who challenge your ideas. Mm-hmm. and help you to pitch your ideas in a better way to get the time, resources, funding, those mm-hmm. kinds of things that you need, to embrace the creative friction, mm-hmm. to, you know, really say like, okay, we're hitting a wall. What's my part in this? What's everyone else's part in this? How do we, you know, how do we solve this? And if you do hit some, you know, too big of a wall to say, hey, how do we go around this? Or what's a different direction? Or, whoa, this isn't working. We need to switch. And then to just build up that resilience over time with creative projects and just start small. Mm-hmm. Start with something that you know you can handle and that you're gonna nail. And then mm-hmm. go bigger. And then just keep going bigger and bigger and bigger until you're doing, you know, nationwide projects that are changing the curriculum.
Yeah.
So there you have it. That was Brett Fisher. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed having the conversation, honestly. you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Amazon or wherever it is that you get your podcast? Also, don't forget to click the little subscribe button. They all, I think, have a subscribe button. And maybe tell a friend about it. I still think word of mouth is one of the greatest ways for people to find out about podcasts. We nerd out on podcasts and share ideas as colleagues. And so if you want to do that, that would be great. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something amazing.